you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined this week by critics Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor, Claudia Puig, the president of the LA Film Critics Association and senior programmer for LA's own AFI Film Festival, Charles Solomon, film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, and from CineGods.com, critic Wade Major. We begin this week with Tina, a documentary about Tina Turner, written and directed by Dan Lindsay and T.J. Martin. Claudia, what'd you think of the doc, Tina?
I liked it a lot. I think this film really makes you look at her with fresh eyes and admire her artistry and her survival and her resilience all the more. It's a pretty revealing documentary. It delves into her early years, when she was known as Anna Mae Bullock before she became Tina Turner, and her relationship, obviously, with Ike and her amazing survival. She gave them a fair amount of access, and it also includes footage that we haven't seen before, as well as concert footage and personal photos. And it really is a testament to her unbreakable spirit. It also kind of presents itself as kind of, this is her, not her swan song, but kind of saying goodbye. It's implying that, you know, it's in its closing moments that this is kind of her taking her bows. And she actually asks rhetorically, how do you bow out slowly and just go away? It really captures her energy and her backstory. And of course, it focuses very heavily on her very terrible marriage to Ike Turner, in which he was violent and abusive, and she reinvented herself. But it's kind of ironic because she talks about not being able to escape that, even when she, you know, she's clearly become her own person. She's a huge star, but that abuse kind of haunts her. That storyline haunts her for the rest of her career. And the movie also does it, ironically, in a way. You know, it was way before, obviously, the Me Too movement, when people were talking about that kind of thing. So the specter of Ike is there. But she's also a fully fleshed human, and, you know, he remains a specter. She's now 81. She lives in Switzerland and is happily remarried. So it's a testimony to her finding love, because she felt she never had love. Her mother abandoned her when she was young. And, of course, everything that happened with Ike. And I wish it had delved a little bit more into, she had four children, and we only hear from one of them, who sadly is now deceased. And he committed suicide. And then also there, she had some health problems recently with a kidney transplant, in which her husband donated his kidney. I wish we'd heard a little more about that, but I'm sure she must have laid some ground rules with the filmmakers too.
Such a remarkable life for the icon Tina Turner, of course, with her own autobiography, which was a bestseller, and the film with Angela Bassett portraying her, which was made, gosh, close to two decades ago. Tina's the HBO and HBO Max documentary. Wade, what'd you think?
Well said, Claudia. I think it's a beautiful film about an amazing, beautiful woman who has lived one of the all-time great American stories. I mean, the pitfalls and the triumphs and the recoveries and the comebacks, and there are so many great twists and turns to her life, and she owns it all. That's the nice thing, is she's transparent about it. And so we're able to sort of aggregate everything that we've gone through, the Broadway musical, the biography that she wrote with Kurt Loder, who's extensively interviewed here as well. All of that is put together, and it's a wonderful summation of an extraordinary life.
The HBO and HBO Max documentary Tina, about Tina Turner, is unrated, and it starts streaming next week, or I should say showing next week on HBO and streaming at HBO Max. The comedic drama The Marijuana Conspiracy takes us back to the early 1970s. The film's written and directed by Craig Price. Peter.
Yeah, this is, I know it's sort of billed as a comedy. It has dramatic underpinnings to it. It's based on a real experiment in 1972 in Canada, where five women were recruited or volunteered to be in a 98-day experiment where they would basically be on a marijuana diet to test what harmful effects, if any, came from that. The government that was behind this study was very much hoping for harmful effects because of various political machinations. There's a researcher who's hired who's more of a let the science speak kind of guy, and he's constantly being maneuvered by the big shots to come up with harmful data. It's a very interesting subject for a movie. I'm not sure it really comes across as anything more than that, mainly because it just seems a little too freeform, and it doesn't really, you know, get under the skin of who these women are or what the effects really were on them. I mean, to put it bluntly, we never really see them get stoned a lot, which is sort of a drawback in a film like this. Marie Ward, who plays a Nurse Ratched type, I think was quite good. She comes across as a Nurse Ratched type and then turns into someone much more interesting, and an actress, Tamika Tafari, is good in it. But, you know, I think it's sort of a missed opportunity for one of these inspired by a true life scientific experiment.
The marijuana conspiracy, Wade.
Yeah, I mostly agree with that. I think the whole marijuana aspect to it is really secondary. Really what you're watching is the formation of a sisterhood, an unlikely sisterhood, these women from different walks of life, different needs, different backgrounds, who all come together in this experiment, and as a result of being put under the same stresses and the same parameters, they forge bonds. And there's something very, very appealing to that and something rewarding about that, irrespective of the everything else that's going on. It gets a little mawkish at times, wears its themes a little too forcefully on the sleeve. But the period recreation is beautiful. The performances are absolutely perfect. The actresses are all wonderful. And I can forgive it for whatever its flaws, just because it's you really do get to love these characters and enjoy spending time with them.
The Marijuana Conspiracy, Claudia.
Yeah, I'm echoing what everyone else is saying. I think the sisterhood part is the best part about it. It's definitely an interesting subject, but I feel it was a little schlocky and mawkish. And sometimes the dialogue felt almost satirical. Like, you know, this one boss tells his one of the women, "Don't start with all your women's lib crap. Everything I say is offensive to you broads these days." You know, it just feels like it's almost like a it feels jokey. And then at one point they say peace out, which is a term that didn't come about until the late 80s or 90s. So there's a little bit of anachronisms, but those things kind of took me out of the movie. But I did appreciate the sisterhood, and I felt it was maybe a little 20 minutes too long also.
The Marijuana Conspiracy, written and directed by Greg Price, starring Tamika Tafari and Julia Sarah Stone. It's unrated. You can see it on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The crime action film Nobody stars Bob Odenkirk, Connie Nielsen, and Christopher Lloyd. The film is directed by Ilya Naishuller, and Derek Kolstad is the screenwriter. Wade, what'd you think of Nobody?
Well, they're all calling this the poor man's John Wick. It's not really. This is just another variation of the John Wick theme. Only this time you have Bob Odenkirk in the part, which makes it kind of fresh and enjoyable and interesting. You know, he's a family man, but life is just kind of beating him down. Every day is the same. His relationship with his wife is humdrum. His you know, relationship with his kid is humdrum. Everything is sort of lackluster. But there's something about him we don't know. And of course, we get to know some of these things. And by the end of the movie, the bullets are flying, and it's ridiculous, and it's absurd, and it's excessive. But if you enjoy these kinds of films, which are sort of like a John Woo film taken to the nth degree, it's really a lot of fun. And Christopher Lloyd, who's in two movies this week,
wow,
playing Odenkirk's dad, is really a whole lot of fun too. And RZA shows up, and I can never not like a movie that RZA shows up in.
Nobody, Claudia.
Yeah, I was not a fan. I think I liked it less than Wade. I know I liked it less than Wade. I liked the beginning, and I like how it initially seemed to be exploring how masculinity or manliness is often equated with violence. And, you know, I wish it had explored that question or that assumption. Instead, it just doubled down on it, and it felt really glib and unexamined. And I think, you know, living as we do in times where men are opening fire on innocent people in spas or grocery stores, this kind of feels unnecessary at best and maybe irresponsible at worst. You know, the whole idea of the revenge of the better male, and, you know, that he's sort of castrated by his family. And I don't know. I just don't think we need another murderous white guy proving to his family that he's, you know, he's a tough guy. But, you know, if you like John Wick, which I don't, but if you do, you might like this. I do like Bob Odenkirk, and I think that he has some good moments. He's, you know, I would personally prefer to watch Better Call Saul, But he has a little more natural charm in that, which is tamped down here. And there's just, I wish it was more nuance here, but there's a couple of funny moments. And there's a scene on the bus, which is really well choreographed with just an incredibly long, prolonged, and unbridledly brutal fight. But it is really quite impressive in the way that it's staged.
Nobody is rated R, and it's in wide theatrical releases. Movie theaters have opened and are opening, more of them in Southern California. The Spanish action thriller The Vault stars Freddie Highmore. The film is directed by Jaume Balagro. The film is written by one, two, three, four, five credited screenwriters. That's a lot, Wade.
Yeah, this is the group who made the two Wreck movies in Spain, which were, you know, really successful genre found footage movies, first person found footage movies. This is really Balagueró's audition piece, saying it's about time Hollywood hires me to do one of your big blockbusters and you know, pay me, because this is a big action heist movie. It's got great suspense, amazing production value. It's almost all in English, you know, because it's basically about a heist of an English, primarily English speaking crew trying to get it at an ocean artifact that's buried in this deep vault in Spain, and the authorities have taken possession of it. The thing is, the whole plot is absolutely preposterous. There's just nothing here that makes any sense. It's beyond a Mission Impossible movie. It's off the chart ridiculous and contrived. But if you can forgive that and just sort of enjoy the performances and the craft of the filmmaking, you'll probably have a good time.
The Vault from Spain. Peter, what'd you think?
I liked it. I'm sort of a sucker for heist movies anyway. And even though this is incredibly derivative in almost every way, you know, from the Ocean's movie to Italian Job and everything in between. Having said that, I mean, it's very well done. It's sort of crackerjack direction. The performances are fun. I mean, there are a lot of implausibilities in it, as Wade said. You know, at one point, the Freddie Highmore character, who's a genius engineer, suddenly knows how to speak Spanish fluently. He's a do-gooder who turns into a thief, and we don't really know why, et cetera. But, you know, it does have a real snap to it, and the background to the heist is the Spain's World Cup final, so that's sort of an exciting juxtaposition. So, you know, I think it's Freddie Highmore is very good in it. Liam Cunningham plays the hunter. It should have been more about Liam Cunningham than the Freddie Highmore character, I think. Cunningham gets a short shrift. But, you know, overall, I think for this kind of movie, it's quite good.
The Vault is rated R, and the film can be seen at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry, in Hollywood at the Arena Cine Lounge Drive-In, and on demand with Fandango Now and Google Play, as well as other platforms. Violet Evergarden, the movie, a Japanese animated film, directed by Taichi Ishidate. Charles, what do you think of Violet Evergarden, the movie?
Well, this film comes with a rather tragic background. This was what the artists at Kyoto Animation were working on when they suffered the murderous arsonist attack. And then when they were able to complete it, it was, of course, delayed by COVID. It's based on, it's a sequel to a popular anime series based on a light novel about a robot girl who was first used as a weapon during the war, kind of a standard anime trope. And now she's become a doll. She's a professional ghostwriter, writing primarily letters for other people, expressing their emotions to people they love. And they're trying to juggle kind of three plots or subplots at the same time. There's her Violet's search for the man she served with during the war, whom she adores. There's one involving a dying child who's trying to write to his family and friends through her. And then there's a young girl whose great-grandmother had hired this Violet to write letters for her. And they really don't juggle them too skillfully. And the film is probably about at least 20 minutes too long, but it delivers what the fans of this series want. And it's kind of the anime equivalent of an old three-hanky weeper.
Violet Evergarden, the movie. Wade, do you have a quick thought on it?
Yeah, Charles summed that up absolutely perfectly. The only thing I would add is it's a beautiful score by Evan Call, who's an American composer based in Japan who writes a lot of anime scores, and this is a beautiful score.
The film again, a Japanese animated movie, Violet Evergarden, the movie. It's unrated, and it's going to be in wide theatrical release starting next week on March 30th. Charles, is this for all ages quickly?
I would say this is for you should be at least an adolescent. It's not as a film for small children. There's okay. some violence and the very complicated emotional entanglements.
All right, so. Violet Evergarden, the movie. When we come back, we'll hear about the comedic drama Shoplifters of the World and the British thriller 6 Minutes to Midnight. It's Film Week right here on KPCC. So glad to have you with us for Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Wade Major, Claudia Puig, Peter Rayner, and Charles Solomon. Next up, the comedic drama Shoplifters of the World, set in 1987 Denver. The film stars Helena Howard and Eller Coltrane. The film's written and directed by Stephen Kayak. Claudia, what do you think of Shoplifters of the World?
I enjoyed this film. It was a lighthearted coming-of-age tale, but it was also a journey of sort of self-discovery, dealing with issues of identity and sexuality. So the film traces one crazy night in the life of four friends who are reeling from the sudden demise or breaking up of their favorite band, the iconic British band, The Smiths. So one kid who works in a radio record store decides to hijack a local radio station at gunpoint. And this is very loosely based. They call it based on true intentions, because this actually was sort of an apocryphal story. Apparently there was a fan and he chickened out, turned himself in. He didn't really go in and force the DJ to play Smith's music. But that fan is played by Eller Coltrane, who we haven't seen much of since he was the boy in Boyhood. And he has these conversations with the DJ at the station that he bursts into. And that's the DJ, Full Metal Mickey, is played by Joe Manganiello, who also produced it. He's quite good in it. I like this film. And I have to, full disclosure, I have to admit I am a Smiths fan. It's fun to hear the music, and there's a lot of it. It kind of follows in the footsteps of some of those other movies that we have seen, like Blinded by the Light, where, you know, they're obviously made by fans. That one was about Springsteen. I'd say it's imperfect. The acting is a bit uneven, but Helena Howard, who plays this sort of the object of the record store guy's affections or infatuation, is great. He does it for her to kind of impress her. And it does capture the time when you're young and you're feeling uncertain and disenfranchised, and you're kind of, music means everything to you. And, you know, you feel like the bands are speaking directly to you. They're your anthems. And I think it captures that pretty well.
All right. Shoplifters of the World. Peter.
Yeah, I agree with Claudia, although I think it could have used a little more sort of American graffiti-ish pop fun and lyricism. I think it's more of an interesting idea for a film than the way it's pulled off, but it's enjoyable. I didn't know much about the Smiths, I have to admit. I knew Morrissey, but I think it's actually a funny idea, although it didn't actually happen, that somebody would take a DJ hostage and play only music by one artist. I think that's something that all of us at one time probably wished we could have done in some way.
Shoplifters of the World, but don't try that at home or the radio station. Wade, what'd you think?
I kind of mostly enjoyed Joe Manganiello, who, of course, is also on display in the Snyder Cut of Justice League, coming back as Deathstroke. So he's having a good week. I think he kind of almost steals the movie as the DJ. He's the much-needed comic relief amid all of this just overwrought teen angst. I mean, someone made a movie about 24 hours in the lives of five kids who are distraught because of the Smiths broke up. That's a really threadbare idea for a movie. There's a lot to enjoy here. The performances are good. I mean, it's nicely made, but I get with the central concept.
Shoplifters of the World is unrated, and it's at the Frida Pop-Up Drive-In on April 1st in Santa Ana, and it's available on multiple on-demand platforms such as iTunes, Amazon Prime Video, Google Play, and Vudu. The British thriller 6 Minutes to Midnight stars Eddie Izzard, Judy Dench, and Carla Jury. Andy Goddard is the director, and Celine Jones Eddie Izzard and Andy Goddard are the screenwriters of the film, which is set in 1939. What'd you think of 6 Minutes to Midnight?
Oh, dear. I hate it when people I love make movies that aren't very good. I adore Eddie Izzard. Judi Dench can do no wrong. Jim Broadbent shows up here as well. But it's just such a clumsy script. This whole thing is loosely based on an actual girls' academy in England on the eve of World War II, which was primarily a German girls' school. And the question here is, you know, as the war is about to break out, what are the Nazis going to do they can't leave these girls there. And then there's this whole spy angle that gets wrapped up in here with, you know, Eddie Izzard goes to be a teacher at the school, but he's really working for British intelligence. And they're trying to find out, you know, there's this list of British agents that are stationed in Germany. And it never really explains why all this espionage would revolve around a girls' school, why there would be any information, any intelligence of espionage value at a girls' school. I mean, yes, the girls are the daughters of all of these high-ranking Nazi officials, but there's no reason why the girls' school would be central to an espionage story. But somehow they make it, you know, they try to pull it off, and it's very clumsy, and it doesn't really resolve very well.
6 Minutes to Midnight, Claudia.
I agree 100%. Wade says it well. It's handsomely shot, I will say that, but only mildly or maybe even fitfully entertaining. It's plodding, it's clunky, it's overbearing, it's underwritten. The score tries to, you know, sub in for when excitement should really be happening. It's, you know, this very overwrought score trying to tell us to be tense, but we aren't. And there's some pretty farcical sounding dialogue. But, you know, Judi Dench is so great. And Jim Broadbent, Eddie Izzard, and the seaside locations in the UK were also enjoyable. But there's just a lot of running around and an overheated soundtrack, and it's trying to approximate excitement, but it's just not happening.
6 Minutes to Midnight is rated PG-13. You can see it in select theaters and on several on-demand platforms. The Good Traitor is a Danish drama that stars Ulrik Thomsen. Christina Rosendahl is the director, and it's got three screenwriters, including Rosendahl. Peter, what'd you think of The Good Traitor?
It's kind of conventional, interesting subject. Thomsen plays Henrik Kaufmann, who was the Danish diplomat to the United States. He was posted in Washington, D.C., at the time that the Nazis invaded, took over Denmark, and Kaufmann refuses to capitulate to the Nazis. He refuses to follow their directive, he considers that he alone is the true representative of the free Danish people, as opposed to the president of Denmark. So there's a lot of conflict of a political nature going on in this movie, but most of the conflict is about Kaufmann and his wife, and then his wife's sister, with whom he's had a romantic relationship with as well. And so it turns into kind of a weird triangle. And mostly what you're dealing with is the backstage stuff, and the political stuff doesn't really enter the foreground much, except in very conventional and emblematic way. And so it's a weird movie because it really should be more about, the whole picture instead of just what's going on in this guy's not terribly interesting love life.
The film again is The Good Traitor, Claudia.
Yes, not terribly interesting is just right. This is not a great week for foreign dramas about World War II, apparently. This felt like a banal marital melodrama, and it was a little too much in the foreground. They don't, the marital issues don't really involve us. They try to grab us in with the beginning, which I won't give away, but it's just a kind of a ho-hum period piece. I did think, the diplomacy element was more interesting, the wheeling and dealing that went on there, because his sort of problematic personal life seemed like it was just kind of presented in narrative cliches. And there was just archival footage kind of shoehorned in. So it didn't really work for me.
And the film The Good Traitor, Wade?
Yeah, I largely agree. I find the history fascinating. I was unfamiliar with this history. It continues to be relevant today because the agreement that was signed that gives the United States the right to use air bases or to have an air base on Greenland is still in effect today and still very much a part of the geopolitical equation. So that I found fascinating. But, you know, I wish the production value had been better. The actor who plays FDR doesn't even make any attempt whatsoever to actually convince you that he's playing FDR. It felt underdeveloped and a little bit low grade as far as the production value. And then again, there is the triangle, the romantic triangle, which is supposed to sort of provide some kind of personal backdrop to the historical, but it's just not as interesting as the historical. I wish they had rebalanced that.
The Good Traitor is unrated. It's in select theaters. Check your listings. And available on most of the major on-demand platforms. The documentary Francesco looks at the life of Pope Francis. Evgeny Afanievsky is the director of the documentary. Claudia.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was kind of caught up in it, although I realized this was a completely Vatican-sanctioned, pretty worshipful documentary. And yet I still found it worth watching, I think because of the breadth of the issues that the Pope is concerned about and has traveled, you know, all over the globe to speak about. And you do feel the humility that people talk about, you know, and his wanting to be a man of the people and not, you know, this removed papal presence. I would have preferred a more nuanced and complex portrait of the spiritual leader. But as we saw with Tina Turner, in a way, you know, there are limitations obviously placed on documentarians. And in this case, certainly a lot of limitations, no doubt, by the Vatican and the Catholic Church. So the journalist in me kind of finds that rankling, but the movie watcher appreciated it. And, they went literally all over the globe, from Myanmar to Lampedusa. And we saw his concern with, of course, migrants and refugees, his trip to Cuba. And we hear a lot of his friends and associates speaking of him, and they aren't always, you know, other Catholics. It could be a rabbi in Argentina or a Muslim cleric. So I appreciated that. And we see a lot of the footage of the Pope speaking. We feel his devotion to the poor. It made me sort of long for, there was one really good aspect though, that I did feel was a little bit outside of that PR feeling, which was his interactions with an adult survivor of child sexual abuse in Chile. And that felt more nuanced because the survivor kind of dismisses the Pope, and then he later acknowledges the Pope made efforts, but he's not completely won over. And that felt more honest. I wish I'd been a little bit more moments like that.
The documentary from director Evgeny Afanievsky, Francesco, looking at the life of Pope Francis. It's on the Discovery Plus streaming service, which launched a few weeks ago, and also available on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. It's unrated. Also in a religious vein, the film Lamb of God is a religious musical, stars Casey Elliott, Catherine Thomas, and Tyler Hardwick. Rob Gardner, the writer-director, Wade.
Yeah, Rob Gardner, who wrote and directed, is actually also the composer of the oratorio here. This is a straightforward concert film like we used to watch on PBS back in the day. It is his most famous oratorio about the life of Christ. It has wonderful performances and vocal performances in it. It's a really splendid piece of music, but it is really just a concert film. There's nothing else going on. There are no dramatic interludes or anything of the sort. So just know that going in as this bends toward Easter, that this is, it's a wonderful, wonderful performance, but it is strictly just a performance.
Lamb of God is unrated. It's at the Harkins Chino Hills 18, the Century Stadium 25, and XD. Senior Moment, a romantic comedy, stars William Shatner, Christopher Lloyd, and Gene Smart. Giorgio Serafini, the director, and it's written by Kurt Brungart and Christopher Momini. Claudia, what'd you think of Senior Moment?
Not a whole lot. William Shatner is 90, and that's great. He's, you know, he's still working, and we should all be so lucky. But I felt like this movie was undeserving of the combined talents of everyone involved. William Shatner, Gene Smart, Issa Morales. It's very formulaic, very typical rom-com, but then you layer it in with all the sort of old folk jokes, you know, those tired tropes, and it just feels like the worst of the genre. It's really the very deficient of uninspired.
Senior Moment, Wade.
All of that is true, but I mean, come on, it's William Shatner, and he's 90, and he's romancing Gene Smart. I've got to, as weak as it is, I've got to give it some props for all that.
Senior Moments Unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The Prado Museum, a collection of wonders, Spanish documentary directed by Valeria Parisi. Charles, quick thought on this?
Well, this is a really weird scattergun sort of film. You've got Jeremy Irons intoning great serious things. The Prado is one of the great repositories of Western art, but they can't seem to focus on anything. They've got more than 800 Goyas that could be a documentary in and of themselves, but they'll mention, oh, Goya's Snowfall is being restored right now. Cut to shot of snowflakes falling somewhere. It tells you much less than it should and focuses much less on the staggering collection of art that's Titian and Rubens and Velasquez and Goya. It's, again, a treasure trove of a museum that you really don't get much sense of. It feels more like it's a scattered travel come-on film from Madrid.
The Prado, which is an extraordinary museum, a collection of wonders, the documentary, directed by Valeria Parisi, is Unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema, and Charles will tell us about another documentary, this one from Italy, about Claude Monet's painting Water Lilies. That's all to come. It's Film Week right here on KPCC. We'll also give a quick preview coming up next. The Santa Barbara International Film Festival getting underway soon. Yeah. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Peter Rayner, Charles Solomon, Claudia Puig, and Wade Major. Charles Solomon just reviewed the Prado Museum, a collection of wonders, the documentary, which didn't much impress him, even though the Prado, I'm sure, does. Water Lilies of Monet, the Magic of Water and Light documentary from Giovanni Troilo. Charles, what do you think of this documentary?
Well, this one is often unintentionally funny. Again, Monet's water lily paintings are one of the great treasures of late 19th, early 20th century Western art. No trip to Paris is complete without a visit to the Marmiton or the Orangerie or the D'Orsay to see some of them. But they have a bunch of narrators wandering around generally by the Seine saying these what are supposed to be aperçus that are often non sequiturs. One woman on the Breton coast announces, here Monet discovered water. Well, what had he been drinking all that time? And then at another point, someone else talks about Monet wanted to immerse his audience in an experience, and they cut to a camera that's been put below the surface of the pond at Giverny. And I burst out laughing, and it's just not very much about a really interesting subject.
Water Lilies of Monet, The Magic of Water and Light, is rated G. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema and multiple on-demand platforms. Peter, you have a quick thought on the drama Things Don't Stay Fixed, starring William Gregory Lee, Tara Oakes, and Brendan Bynum?
It's a pretty minor movie with some nice touches around the edges, some good Deep South atmosphere in the direction and cinematography. It's about a sort of deadbeat dad who goes back to his hometown to break up the marriage of his daughter to a guy he doesn't feel is right for her. And, there are certain Southern Gothic elements that are, standard for this kind of film. But I think the director has some gift for atmosphere that could be better utilized with a better script.
That director is Bo Bartlett. The screenwriter is Sandra Deer. Things Don't Stay Fixed, rated PG-13, at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood and the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. And finally, Claudia has for us the Indian comedic drama, Pagalet. What did you think? It's written and directed by Umesh Bist. Claudia?
Yeah, this is an entertaining and empathetic story of a young woman's self-realization. She emerges from under the cocoon of an overbearing family. It's about letting go and forgiving and second chances and kind of, letting go of tradition and maybe forging your way in a more modern world. The lead actress, Sanya Malhotra, is very good. She's only 29. She's already played like a pretty wide variety of roles. And it's well-intentioned and earnest and ultimately pretty satisfying.
Pagalet is streaming on Netflix. The film is unrated. want to give a very brief preview to the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, which gets underway very soon. Our Peter Rayner is typically there for the festival every year, but of course the pandemic has changed everything. Peter, you have a couple of highlights you'd like to direct us toward with this year's edition.
Yeah, there are a lot of tributes. Our good friend and colleague Leonard Maltin is hosting on April 2nd a discussion, live virtual discussion with Bill Murray.
Great.
On the Maltin Modern Master Award. Say that five times real fast. There's also an outstanding directors of panel with Chloe Zhao, David Fincher, Lee Isaac Chung, and Thomas Vinterberg. There's also various writers and women's panels. There's a Cinema Vanguard Award being presented to Carrie Mulligan, a discussion with her. Also, Sacha Baron Cohen is getting Outstanding Performer of the Year on Wednesday, the 7th. This is all on their website. Delroy Lindo is also being honored, as well as Amanda Seyfried. Of the films that are coming up, some that look interesting include Last Call, which is a documentary about two local bars in Queens, New York, that shut down during the pandemic and how they deal with that. Also, a film called Poppy Nongena, N-O-N-G-E-N-A, about a struggling South African mother.
All right. The Santa Barbara International Film Festival gets underway next Wednesday evening. And if you visit SBIFF, the acronym for the festival, .org, you'll be able to see all the selection of films that will be available over the course of the festival. SBIFF.org. We'll have a link on our Film Week page. And finally, we want to remember with our critics the wonderful French filmmaker Bertrand Tavernier, noted for such films as one of my favorite, Round Midnight, starring Dexter Gordon, A Sunday in the Country, Coup de Torchon. Peter, please start us on remembering Tavernier.
Yes, all of those films and many more are wonderful. He started out as a publicist, and then he also was a great film historian. He did a number of documentaries, Journey into French Cinema, that was shown in two parts here. That's quite extraordinary. He wrote a book on American cinema. I had dinner with him and other journalists at the Toronto Festival years ago, and he's just a remarkably engaging, convivial guy, a walking encyclopedia of film, but not in any way stuffy or academic. He really was a unique artist and film person right down to the very core.
He died at the age of 79. He had been battling a pancreatic infection, but his death believed to be rather abrupt, according to Variety. Claudia, your memories of Tavernier's work?
Like you, Round Midnight is one of my absolute favorites. He was just, I did not realize he had once been a publicist, though. That is so interesting how other filmmakers have also
DuVernay, right?
Root. Ava DuVernay was the first person that was coming to mind. Yes. Oh yeah. I mean, just being able to do the range of films that he has done, and such an amazing career. It's a huge loss.
Wade, quick thought.
I mean, he died a month shy of his 80th birthday, and it just kills me. He was one of my great heroes. I met him once, like Peter, and he just infects you with love for cinema. And he made dozens of movies, and there's not a bad film in the lot. Captain Conan, L627, one of the great all-time crime films. It's not available on Blu-ray. It really needs to be. He won for Fresh Bait. He won the Berlin Film Festival, another amazing film that we programmed in a series some years ago. I mean, really one of the all-time great filmmakers ever, and certainly one of the greatest France ever produced. It is a huge loss.
George Segal passed away earlier this week at the age of 87. Such a strong film career early on, and then with long-lasting appearances on situation comedies, Just Shoot Me and The Goldbergs. But, of course, Wade, I think back to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? What a great performance.
Amazing. And when you think about what he does in that film, he is up there with two of the giants in the history of the screen, and he's navigating both of them, and he's keeping that film balanced. It's really remarkable to watch him, what he does in their shadows. And then, of course, I mean, A Touch of Class, The Owl and the Pussycat, Where's Papa? We could just go on and on and on. I would almost argue in every movie that he made, he was just about the best thing in it.
Where's Papa? Oh, gosh, love it. Claudia, thoughts on George Segal's passing?
I feel like I've grown up watching him, and then there was a movie in which he had a very small part, but it was so great, and I think he almost stole the movie too. Was in David O. Russell's film Flirting with Disaster, where he played the father of the lead character.
He's
remember
really
that
good
Ben Stiller's
in that.
Dad? Yeah, and he was married to Mary Tyler Moore. Yeah, he was great. He's just so I just think of his. I know he could also do drama really well, but his comedic timing and everything was just amazing.
And Peter, quick thought on Siegel.
He was the first person I ever interviewed, the first celebrity interview when I was a sophomore in college. He came to campus. This was around the time of Where's Papa, Alan the Pussycat. You know, a marvelous, marvelous comedic actor. His career started in the mid-60s with films like King Rat. His comic gifts are well known. I want to just point out quickly two or three of his dramatic films. Loving, L-O-V-I-N-G, not to be confused with the more recent film of that title, with Eva Marie Saint, is an absolutely extraordinary movie and a great performance. Bloom in Love, with Paul Mazursky film, he's marvelous in that.
Yeah.
And the best performance I think he ever gave, which is missing from all the obits I've read, a film called Born to Win by the late, great Yvonne Passer with Karen Black. He plays a drug addict. It's an absolutely extraordinary movie, and they should bring it back. It shows you the tremendous range that he has, as did California Split. He was always wonderful with other performers, and Elliot Gould in California Split, and he were just marvelous together in that Altman film. Really an incredibly versatile actor.
George Siegel, dying at the age of 87 earlier this week, an extraordinary body of film work, and known, I'm sure, to many of our younger Film Week listeners for his many TV appearances in the last couple decades of his life. It's Film Week on KPCC. Coming up, Zack Snyder, the director, in conversation with our John Horn.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.